Good morning, everybody. I think today we can't tell whether it's going to be a sunny day or whether it's going to be a cloudy day. So we get a little bit of both. Now, I don't know if you're like me, but there have been times where in life I have allowed either people or circumstances to be the thing that I allowed to be in charge of my attitude. Have you been there? The question is, ought that be the case? You know, so when we wake up in the morning, are we going to allow the fact that somebody is a grump, whoever that might be, that we might encounter? Are we going to let that make us a grump? Or, you know, are we going to walk around? Yeah, I know this is too simplistic, but it's the old half, you know, glass half empty, glass half full kind of thing. I'll be honest with you, I struggle to see the glasses half full. I'm most of one of those that kind of lean towards the glasses half empty. Now, I try to think about ways that I can rearrange the way that I think about stuff like that. But honestly, there's times where that's my first thought. You know, when it comes to sometimes dealing with other folk, I'm a lot more, I know that I ought to be wise and discerning, but sometimes I'm actually just really not very hopeful when it comes to the agenda of people that I have to interact with. I don't know if you're like me, but all that very easily can determine the trajectory of my attitude in any given day, if I allow it to. If you're like me, it's sort of like the working out that I'm not doing. If I worked out a little bit more, then I would certainly not be where I am right now physically. Same thing with my attitude. If I worked out with my attitude and I focused on dealing with the things that I allow to affect my attitude, whether it is an interaction with somebody or a circumstance, you know, nothing will mess with your attitude like a call at 12:30 at night from your kid who's 8 hours away, whatever that might be. And sometimes they don't have to be 8 hours away. So what I want to talk about today is what I talked about 11 and kind of flesh out some of the things about this idea of we're supposed to have this new attitude, and that everything that we see Paul teaching and much of what we see in other places in the New Testament as well has to do with the fact that we are supposed to in some way have responsibility for this attitude we have. And it's not just something that we can expect God to magically wash up for us and set us up on the right course, and it's all God's responsibility, because that's not what I see in Scripture. It's like God's done all this stuff. He's given you His grace, His mercy. He's allowed His joy to be a part of who we are and what we do. And then there's this big thing of we have a choice as to whether we're going to let those things be what determines our attitude, or whether we're going to keep wallowing in the pigsty, which has to do with all the ugliness and the stuff that causes us to be hard to live with. Does this make sense for you? So let's talk about the first illustrations that I brought up last week, and I want to ask you a question. So what is the evidence that a change of attitude took place, first of all, in the life of Jacob? Have you ever thought about the life history of Jacob? We know we talked a little bit about where he started, but think about Jacob and the things that would indicate perhaps his attitude. What are some things Jacob did that might in some way reveal some attitudes that he had? Okay. Why would somebody do that? Did jealous, greed? Okay. I want to give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it's not just greed. Maybe it's not just jealousy. Maybe it is. Maybe it's not. If it's not, why would somebody do that? Well, his mama. He's mom's boy. Could be. I don't know that I see anything in Scripture that says that Jacob wasn't responsible for his choice. Now, it does seem, from our viewpoint, it seems a little bit stringent to be saying, yeah, see, he was hanging on to that heel from the day he came out. Therefore, he was who he, you know, and that maybe is an illustration that indicates a bent that he had in life. Don't think God ordained that. Whenever I take something Is it just that I'm greedy? If I'm a kid and I go to the store and I steal a pack of candy. What is it that motivates me to steal the pack of candy? Could be. I was one of those knuckleheads that thought it's the challenge. Now, can I get away with it? And usually that had something to do with the community involvement of my peers, you know, that kind of thing. That's a possibility. But I think a lot of times people justify what they do whenever they do stuff like that by, it's based on a belief that they can't get it any other way or that it will not be provided for them. I guess what I'm thinking about is with Jacob, Jacob wanted that birthright because he didn't have one. He wasn't going to get it. He wasn't the oldest born. There was no way that was not going to be provided for him because he felt like he was not provided for. He was not in that esteemed, blessed position of being the firstborn. Then he didn't have it. Couldn't get it. So the only way he could get it was by, in this case, deception, stealth, and trick. You know, being a tricky guy. So this is the kind of person he was. What are some other things in his life that indicate the kind of attitude he might have had? Do you remember? So he stole the birthright. What else did he do? He stole something else too. And we don't think about this because it's not a part of our culture. Stole the birthright. He also stole the blessing. Okay, there were two different things. Okay, birthright was you get the right of all the stuff that the father has, the firstborn. The blessing was something that kind of went along with it, but it was separate. It was being acknowledged as being the leader of the family, the clan. Okay, and usually the firstborn got that, but it was a separate thing from the actual kind of you get stuff. So what did he do to get that? Deception. And this is where, yeah, mom was a little bit, she was complicit in all that. Okay, you remember the story? Okay, because Esau was all hairy. Okay, and why was that effective? Why would that be effective? Something to me says dad must have been down the line of perhaps not just blind, but also his other perceptive abilities had in some way been compromised. Because you would think that you'd be able to tell if somebody's got skin strapped on them, you know? What about whenever Jacob went to go see his uncle or cousin, Laban? Remember what happened back in Haran when he goes to see Laban? Yeah, he did. It kind of boomeranged on him. Kind of, you know, take what you get what you take. So he still had the attitude of, if I don't take it, it won't be coming to me. But then he engaged and found that Laban had the same philosophy. So then all these things are a part of who he is. What is the evidence that he's different on the other end? After he wrestles with the angel, as he's going back, right before he's going back to see his brother, what are some things that would indicate that post that experience that he is different, that his attitude is different? Okay, so you think those were gifts, those were bribes. Maybe he won't kill me. That's right, we're going to put everybody in front and we're going to send them on and I'm going to stay here tonight. Okay, all right, okay. Ultimately, how did Jacob handle that? Whenever he actually saw Esau, do you remember kind of how that went down? What was Jacob's attitude? The old Jacob would never do that. Bless you. Old Jacob would not do that. New Jacob acknowledged his responsibility and the way he had treated his brother. It wasn't just, I'm scared he's going to kill me. It was like after he wrestled with that angel, something changed. And then he ultimately becomes Israel, father of many nations. Got all these kids, and his attitude's different. You remember on the end of all of this, let's see how to ask this. How did God use the change in him to eventually bless? You ever think about that? Bless you and me, bless all God's people, from the guy that had the bad attitude to the guy that had a different viewpoint, different attitude. All right. Second example. So what's the evidence that took place, or of things that took place in Saul's life before he became Paul? What was Saul like before? Okay. He was, the only word I think fits him is rabid. He was rabid in his animosity towards anybody that had anything to do with faith, that had to do with Jesus. What, say again? He was. Yes, he was. So, if we know that this was the attitude, what do you think caused, I mean, I know some of this is guessing, but what caused Paul, Saul at that time, to have this attitude? Okay. So he turned the fervency and the passion into something that was directed at life instead of death. You know, I think the old Saul, I cannot see saying anything about a thorn in the flesh that Paul did. I can't see that guy saying anything about weakness and about God using something in his life that troubled him, or, you know, that kept limiting him in some way. That, to me, was an attitude change. Also, the whole idea of, if you look at the things that came against him, you see several times in the Corinthian letters where he's talking about all these things happened, and I just don't see the attitude of the early guy being able to see how God could work in all those kind of circumstances that seemed to be so negative, so against him. There's a different mindset in the two attitudes. You see what I'm saying? Same persistence, maybe, but there's a different attitude about what's going on. All right. John, next slide. So we've talked about that. Go ahead and flip to the next thing. Yep, I put that extra in there. All right, so we're back to the Beatitudes. So when we look at the Sermon on the Mount, what Jesus said in the Beatitudes, here is my question. Which of these, and there are several of them, attitude objectives is the most challenging for you? So is it in some way recognizing your own spiritual poverty, how much you need God? Is it embracing the fact that we all grieve and feel loss, and that we feel helpless at times because of that, powerless? Is it accepting that quiet strength and not prideful self-promotion places us in God's hands for use? Is it believing that we really do need to become like Jesus? And I'll say that's kind of, for me, is verse 6. The whole idea of righteousness is, you know, something that we can only have through Jesus, because it's His righteousness that's credited to us, not our own. And, or is the attitude that's difficult for you to show, the idea of showing mercy to other people? What's tough for you, Carol? Now, that's not an attitude. That's a command, actually. You know, I think when it comes to the idea of being poor in spirit, there's two different takes on that. One is, we can be so spiritual, end quote, that we can become arrogant and think that we're always right. The other is that we can take the exact opposite view and say, I can never be whatever the objective is, more like Jesus, therefore I just won't even try. And that's pretty poor in spirit, but it's in the wrong way. So you can kind of take that in the wrong way if you wanted to. Because anything that I see there about that attitude, that's not what's being communicated. But I do know people that would kind of use that in a way to kind of check out from having to engage in the process of becoming more like Jesus. So the attitude, you know, that would be an attitude that doesn't really have anything to do with this. This is an attitude of one where we're supposed to aspire to something, and so it's not an attitude where we're saying it can't be done, or we can't, you know, this is impossible. That's not what Jesus was talking about. I think a lot of us struggle, at least I know, at times I do, the idea of quiet strength versus the whole idea of, you know, our culture tells people, teaches people to take initiative and to be a proactive, be a, you know, go-getter kind of thing. So the whole idea of blessed are the meek, for they'll inherit the earth, is very, very countercultural. And I think that it's quite confusing for us a lot of times. Understanding, well, how much is a Christian supposed to speak up or be engaged, or, you know, because the whole, you guys know, I mean, just with all the stuff that's flown around in the last 30 years in terms of culturally and politically, you know, it's like, you know, you're a Christian, sit down, shut up. Or you're a Christian, you're supposed to get in there and you're supposed to, you know, let them know and, you know, get in control and make changes. And that's a tough thing to navigate at times, because it is so culturally defined, whichever extreme you want to, you know, to deal with or buy into. But here Jesus is saying attitudinally, it's those who are meek, quiet strength. That doesn't mean that we're not supposed to speak when we need to speak. Jesus did. He went into the temple. He overturned the tables. He said, you're a bunch of vipers and snakes, and you got to stop using God's temple this way. So it's not that we're not supposed to say, but there's a whole agenda that goes along with what the culture says you're supposed to do whenever you're supposed to. It's not just take initiative. It's more of, you know, you're supposed to be, and I don't know that I see that anywhere. You see that anywhere? Yeah. You know, where any Christian is supposed to be seeking to take control of some governmental structure. Those things can affect my attitude real quick. You know, I can get really grumpy, really angry at stuff that I know is wrong. You can too, because there is the Holy Spirit works in us and shows us what and gives us discernment over what is right and what is wrong. And the problem is we don't always know what to do with that discernment that we have. Now, that's the challenge, I think, about the attitude. Is it that we're supposed to stay locked and loaded in being grumpy and angry, or are we supposed to be redemptive and transformative? And how do we navigate that? Because you and I know, I remember whenever Abby was a senior, Abby was at Jenkins. And the church from Kansas came to Savannah, sent their little contingent of 15 to 20 people to go protest at Jenkins High School in Savannah, Georgia, about some issue that they want. And this was that group that's really grumpy and really mean-spirited, and they believe it's their job to go protest at military funerals and stuff, you know, whatever their message is, okay? Their message comes across as being judgmental and angry. I don't think that has anything to do with the attitude that we're supposed to have. Could they be concerned about some things there? Yeah, okay, they can. And could they communicate that? Yes, they could. But they don't have to represent Jesus as being angry and judgmental. Does that make sense? Because nobody wants to listen to these people anymore. They are now a caricature, a negative stereotype. They no longer represent any kind of redemption, nor grace, nor transformation. They're just these crazy people. Attitude. Okay, John, next slide. So here's the others. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Peacemakers, persecuted. Some of what we've been talking about. Is it a challenge for you and me to have an attitude where we are willing for our lives to be somewhat transparent, so that we're not trying to hide stuff? Because y'all know there's nothing that kills your attitude like trying to hide stuff. So pure in heart, how do you keep a pure heart? How do you have a pure heart? So again, it's responsible for taking on the attitude, for picking up that attitude. And not letting other things, you know, Jesus talked a lot about, especially when he was talking with the religious leaders, about the yeast that gets mixed into the dough that causes the dough to rise. Well, there's stuff that causes the yeast of a bad attitude to get into our lives as well. And so keeping a pure heart, I think, has to do with recognizing that we don't want that in. And so we can't let that in, which means we can't put ourselves in those environments where we know we're likely to pick up some yeast along the way, and that we are responsible for those influences. So being pure in heart also means that we can't let that stuff take root in us. We can't let it stay in us and then grow. So pure in heart has to do with the idea of being honest about failure, being honest about sin, confessing, repenting, allowing our lives to be transparent, because nothing causes trouble like somebody trying to act like, I don't want to use that analogy. That's a sports analogy I'm not going to use. Okay, I'll just use a different one. If you don't take a shower for 3 weeks, and then you act like you don't smell like you haven't taken a shower in 3 weeks, you're not dealing with reality, right? All right. So that's a better analogy. That to be pure in heart, we have to do the things that keep our heart clean. It's not just not doing the stuff that causes trouble. It's both. It's both and. So the attitude that says, I need to be honest about this, and I need to keep my spirit and my life maintained, has to do with this allowing God to correct us and convict us, and then we act on it, and then we don't have to worry about trying to hide anything. Just think, how did Peter handle what he had to do, what he did? Think about it. He denied Jesus, and all those that he hung out with the most for 3 years knew exactly what he had done that night when Jesus was taken away. He said, I won't do that. Jesus said, yes, you'll do it. And then he did it. And then he knew that all those other people that he hung around knew that he did that. He denied Jesus 3 times. And then Jesus came back and, you know, did the re-engaging of, you know, Peter, do you love me? Which was a way for Jesus to redirect Peter's guilt and then also his trajectory for who he meant for him to be. But that certainly could have affected his attitude long term if he had not had that dealt with, if it hadn't been open. How are you at making peace? And what does that mean? What does it mean to make peace? And how does that have anything to do with attitude? Okay. Peacemakers. Do peacemakers, I think the problem in the culture is that the perception is that peacemakers in some way ignore the injustice or the hurt that perhaps has taken place between the parties. And I don't know that that is what Jesus is talking about. Peacemaking is a challenge because it doesn't do that, I believe. It acknowledges hurt. It helps parties listen to one another. It helps people move forward when consensus is possible. It seeks that. But it also, it does not try to stuff things into a dark place and go on like it never. Attitude. So having an attitude where we are willing to do that. Again, most people, their first thought about that is, oh, let's not deal with that. Time heals all. Now I hear Dr. Phil. How'd that work out for you? Blessed are the persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. That was something that Carol brought up a little while ago. What's the problem with persecution? How does persecution affect a lot of people? If you persecute me, does that determine my attitude? How are we supposed to defend ourselves? It may be a trick question, by the way. Who's your defender? Now, the reality is, we can have a debate, and I'm not here to create a debate here, but I think we would all acknowledge that the animosity between the God, not God, is growing in this nation. And the comfort level of believers in this nation is changing for those who really are following Jesus and are not just bought into a cultural ascension to religion. I was reading the other day, we have now hit a point where there's, as described, a third of the country is of the Catholic faith, a third of the country is of the evangelical faith, and a third of the country is relatively nothing, generally. Now, I'm not sure where, because I didn't see anything acknowledging anybody else, like, you know, all the other religious, but the argument was that the country is becoming less and less faith oriented, and as that happens, we have to understand that we're becoming more like what the first century believers dealt with. We're not there, but we're becoming more like that than we have been in the history, in that the culture is less friendly, and it's going to continue to be less friendly. How do we then, if we're persecuted more overtly and sometimes subvertly, how do we deal with that? And the thing is, we're supposed to be like Jesus. How did Jesus deal with it? Say it again. Okay, he did. And did he lead a revolt? Did he even preach to try to incite people to lead a revolt? Ultimately, he let God defend him and realized that there was a bigger picture that was being laid out. And we have got to, as believers in this country, allow God to be the one who defends us. And we have to trust His, be strong, be who He is, He's called us to be. But at the same time, realize that if we lose what we consider to be control over the structures are not what defends us. It's our God who defends us. And if we don't let Him do it, people will not see God. They'll see us being political. And that's different from blessed are the persecuted, for theirs is the kingdom. So have you ever been in a situation where you had to let God defend you? Because it can be. I mean, you'd like certainty. You'd like to know you can control. But, you know, the truth is, sometimes you just have to say, okay, God's in charge of this. I'm going to let my character, I'm going to let who I am speak, and then let God use and do what He's going to do to defend, and just give Him glory whenever He does what He does. And that is a huge effect on our attitude. Because if we start acting like, poor, poor, pitiful me, I'm a victim. Oh, I'm a Christian and everybody's against me. I don't think that's the attitude we're supposed to have. All right. So what keeps us from living these attitudes? Okay. What makes these attitudes superior? You ever think about that? Why are these the ones I'm supposed to have? I hear you. Or driving in Miami, that was an interesting. We acknowledge it. We know that it is a part of the journey. Jesus said, they persecuted me. What are they going to do with us? They're going to do the same thing. So what's new? But unfortunately, because we have enjoyed so much freedom and so much of the influence of the Judeo-Christian influence in the beginning of this nation, it wasn't perfect. We've never been perfect. Hopefully we're going to be honest, but the bottom line is we have the best hope for things to be possible, and yet we still kind of mess it up. It just reminds us that the government's not going to save us. Okay? Men are not going to save us. We have to trust God and then follow Him and let our relationship with Him determine our attitudes, not what anybody says about us, whether it's truth or lie. Because the problem is sometimes whenever they start telling us good things, it sets us up. If someday I'd like to sit down and talk to Tim Tebow. And here's why. Okay? Because the culture built him up and then the culture shot him down. And yet, even though the culture didn't ever understand any of that much, he has found a way to, at least seemingly, let God be his defender. Again, it has nothing to do with fame or importance. It has to do with that's just what happened in a microcosm in his life. I would love to be able to listen to just have a conversation with them about that sometime. Okay. Anything else you want to say about attitude? Never even got back to the Ephesian passage, never got to Philippians 2. Those are challenging to me, and so I brought them up, and we'll see how we do. I may revisit this again just a little bit before we move on next week. Let's pray. Russell, would you close us in prayer?